exposes corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, what a day. The Bug Man. The Bug Man says, it's all a conspiracy to get me. Yes, Tom DeLay is the persecuted one here. We'll get to that a little later in the day. A United States senator says George W. Bush went to war just to get himself reelected. We'll get to that a little later in the day. It is the anniversary of the Exxon Valdez. Remarkable stuff. And the right to profit. The right to profit. This rather interesting take on what, you know, what are the rights of American corporations? But, you know, before we get into all that stuff, first we have with us Dr. Yaron Brook. Dr. Yaron Brook is the director of the, or the president, as I recall, of the Ayn Rand Foundation. Is that right, Yaron?
Ayn Rand Institute. The,
Ayn Rand
President
Institute.
And executive director. Yeah.
There we go. Okay, thank you. And your website is Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. And I always enjoy speaking with you and Dr. Bernstein. You guys are... What I really appreciate about you is that you don't try to sugarcoat your perspectives. You just lay it out. You know, we get folks who call themselves conservatives in this program. I know you don't call yourself a conservative. We had a guy yesterday telling us, oh, there's, you know, mercury's not toxic, and it turns out, you know, he's drawing his paycheck from the big energy companies. And it's like, you know, people doing this song and dance. You guys at least have an ethical perspective. And in fact, there are a lot of things on which we agree. The government has no right in our bedrooms, for example. Mm-hmm. But Ayn Rand's thinking, of course, conservative thinking, you know, goes back to William Burke or Edmund Burke and before, back to the 1600s and before that. But it has been, the modern conservative movement has been so colored by Ayn Rand's writings and the objectivism which you espouse, which then in some ways morphed into a political organization, which is the Libertarians, which then in some ways, and again with variations that I know in many of them you disagree with, morphed into things like the Cato Institute and many of the modern conservative movements. And so I think it's really important for our listeners to hear from folks like you who really are the kind of the original thinkers of this thing. And so I appreciate you coming on, Dr. Brook.
My pleasure.
Today is the 16th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez running aground on a reef in Prince William Sounds, Alaska, dumping 11 million gallons of crude oil onto Alaska's shore. Regarding ANWR, your colleague, Dr. Bernstein, just wrote this piece about the drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. At what point do we, the people, through our elected representatives, get to decide that the policies of a particular industry are harmful to us?
Well, I don't think it is our role as we, the people, to make those kind of decisions. The majority should not rule in cases of private property. Now, if a specific industry is causing specific, well-defined harm to particular individuals, the court systems have existed for hundreds of years to arbitrate such disputes. If you can show that the plant across from where you live is spewing stuff that is clearly causing you, you know, health problems, then there is a court system where you can go and demand damages for that. The government should not be involved in regulating what business does in any respect.
But doesn't business come into being as a result of government? I mean, we the people authorize corporations to form. You have to, if you want to start a corporation, you have to go to the local Secretary of State's office and file papers. Corporations are using currency, which is maintained in a stable form by we the people through our creation of currency, the Treasury Department. They use the court systems, which are brought into being by we the people. Aren't corporations creatures of government?
Well, no more than any contract is a creature of government. I don't think any of those are creatures of government. Let me give you, for example, you mentioned the monetary system. Indeed, it is a corruption of the monetary system to have a Federal Reserve and have government printing money. I think that is a real perversion and has caused us both great depressions and great inflationary periods. I'd love to see the Federal Reserve privatized and have banks printing money. But I do not believe that corporations are a contractual relationship. They're a contractual relationship between shareholders, managers, employees, and bondholders. those contractors are those contracts are protected by government, just like any contract is protected by government. But just like, I don't think it is the role of government to get into, let's say, what constitutes a marriage contract. I don't think it is the government's responsibility to regulate how corporations behave with regard to their contracts. These are voluntary relationships between adults who can then, you know, bondholders and,
right.
and
okay.
all
you,
these
you,
different
you've
interest
raised,
groups.
You've raised a number of points here. Let's go through a few of them. First of all,
sure.
I would agree with you that if you and I are entering into an agreement outside of government, if for example, you say, okay, you mow my lawn for a year and I'll paint your house, that's a barter. That's the true free market. But once we sign a contract and we say we're going to use the court system to enforce this contract, now we've brought government into it, and government is collective society. It's not just two individuals.
No, that's where I disagree. Government is not collective society. Government is instituted among people for one purpose and one purpose only, as America was founded, and I think as every country should be founded, and that is to protect individual rights. In other words, the only purpose of government is, in a sense, to protect the legitimacy of that contract that we just signed and to make sure that neither of us violates the contract and to make sure, and if we do, to compensate the other. And to make sure that we don't kill each other, that we don't cheat each other, we don't commit fraud against each other.
Sure,
that's
sure.
It.
So if we have a
any
corporation.
Other involvement of government in people's lives, whether it be our private lives in the bedroom or our economic lives, is a perversion of the role of government and the role of the majority.
So if we have a corporation or we have an industry which is encouraging us to consume more and more oil, and as a consequence of this, we are spending hundreds of billions of dollars and thousands of lives of our people to protect our oil supplies around the world, and we are suffering epidemics of autism as a consequence of mercury being pumped into the air from power plants, and there is a clear harm, and yet there isn't any clear remedy through the court system for this. Historically, what we have done is we have said, we've collectively gotten together, and we've said, okay, we the people, we're going to establish policies which are going to encourage certain kinds of behavior and discourage other kinds of behavior. For example, we wanted to encourage homeownership. So we said you can deduct your income tax. From your income tax, you can deduct your interest payments.
Yeah.
What's wrong with government saying, okay, the oil industry here is pushing, you know, in these secret meetings with Dick Cheney and all this kind of stuff, is pushing for all these, you know, welfare payments. I mean, there's $9 billion in welfare to the oil industry in Cheney's secret oil policy meetings. And they're encouraging drilling, and now we're drilling in Anwar, when, in fact, we could just as easily say, okay, if we simply mandated that the CAFE standards, the fuel efficiency standards of the entire auto fleet in the United States, went up 3 miles per gallon, we would save more oil than is in all of Anwar. In fact, we wouldn't even need to import oil from Saudi Arabia anymore. We could leave that part of the world. Why don't, you know, what's wrong with us doing that?
Well, there are lots of things wrong with it. Once you start violating people's rights, there's no end to the violation of rights. Once you accept that it's okay to tell me what kind of car I can buy and not buy, then there's no difference between that and telling me who I can and cannot sleep with.
Well, actually, in this case,
once
we're saying if you're a company,
you
what kind of...
Rights,
I got your point, but what we're saying is this is not the kind of car you can buy, but it's the kind of car you can sell.
It makes no difference. The person who produces the car has as much rights as I have in terms of buying the car.
But it's not a person, it's a corporation.
What if I imported it from Japan? What if I imported it from China? See, you are legislating what I can buy.
But it's not a person, it's a corporation.
Let me also add that I'm against the government providing incentives for home ownership. I'm against the government trying to provide me incentives to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Leave me alone. That's what I want the government to do. I want the government to be out there protecting my individual rights, protecting me from fraud and from murder and from thievery and protect me from Islamic terrorists and leave me alone to manage my life. And I have a huge respect for the capacity of individuals to make rational, good decisions about their private lives in the bedroom and in their economic lives. And what I want is the government to leave us alone as producers, as makers of cars, and as consumers of cars. Just let us live our lives the way we want to live them. And don't provide us with incentives with regard to trying to manipulate our behavior with regard to anything.
But what if those Islamic terrorists are coming after us because our oil industry and our auto industry are encouraging behavior that put us in their face, I mean,
if you read the Islamic terrorists and you read why they're coming to us and the intellectual roots of the Islamist movement, it has nothing to do with oil. They hated the West well before there was any oil in the Middle East and well before there were automobiles. So to associate Islamic terrorism with the oil industry and with our consumption of oil, I think is just ridiculous. Islamic terrorism are coming after us because they want to establish an Islamic empire over the Middle East, and this is the way they think they can achieve that. That's it.
But why are we in the Middle East?
Because they want to kill us.
Why are we in the Middle East? They're not. You know, in 1998, Osama bin Laden issued a...
We have an essential... We have property rights associated with the Middle East. We are the ones who discovered oil in the Middle East. We are the ones...
So it's our oil.
We are the ones who piped it, and we have essential interests there to protect that oil flow, and I think that's a completely legitimate... function of government to protect the property rights of Americans.
So because we found oil on their land, it belongs to us.
Not their land. There's no such thing as collective land. I don't own the oil in Texas. Exxon and Mobil own the oil of Texas. America doesn't own the oil in Texas any more than the Saud family has any legitimate right to the oil in Saudi Arabia. They have no right. They
so you're suggesting that the rights
American corporations that drilled for it.
So you're suggesting that the rights of a corporation should trump the rights of sovereign people, of nations or of individuals.
I don't consider monarchy a sovereign people or a dictator a sovereign people, but I believe that all property in the world on earth should be privately owned and that private interests, whether by corporations, individuals, every piece of land should be owned by private individuals, and everybody will be better off if that actually happened.
And we should have no public land. We should have no public parks. We should have no national wildlife reserve. We simply do away with it. Sell it off.
Was built by private enterprise. It was not a public park. It was built by private individuals who believed that creating a park like that would enhance the quality of life of their own quality of life and the quality of life of their employees.
But they handed it off to the city to pay for.
All land, including our national parks, including ANWR, should be privately owned by individuals and corporations. And if you want wilderness, if somebody wants wilderness, if somebody wants, then they can buy up a chunk of land and not allow anybody on it because it's their land, and they can preserve the spotted owl and the moose and whatever they want to.
Well, aren't you saying then that the rich get to define the terms of the world in which we live?
I'm saying that the people who have money get to own a big chunk of the land. But as you said, a lot of people own their homes, for example, in the United States. What they do in their homes is their business. I don't want to interfere. If I happen to make a lot of money because I was productive, because I was competent, then I should be able to do whatever I want on my piece of land.
Okay. Dr. Yaron Brook is the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Yaron Brook, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate your sharing your perspective.
My pleasure, as always.
Thank you. We'll talk again. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour. The pill that will help you escape the matrix.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And see, here we get down now to the essential argument that is actually the argument behind the argument that's been put forward by George W. Bush, although he's not sufficiently honest to just come right out and say it. About, for example, ANWR, or, for example, Social Security. The idea that, with, for example, Social Security, the notion that, it's the government really has no business being involved in our lives. That if we, the people, get together and we decide that we don't want to have poverty among us, and right now the reality is not that different from the late 1930s when Social Security was created, that although right now about 11.6% of elderly Americans live in poverty, if you took away Social Security, that number would rise to 47% overnight. And it was in the 60 to 70% range in the 30s when Social Security was instituted. So it's not that huge a difference. But that there is a philosophy out there. Alan Greenspan was initiated into the cult of objectivism in Ayn Rand's apartment in New York City in the 1950s. He's still out there pushing this stuff. This and there is an absolutely consistent worldview there, which I have to say, you know, I respect their consistency. I think that they are dreamy-eyed idealists and that they're wrong, but you have to respect their consistency. The problem is when people try to promulgate these beliefs, you get folks that you know, Stephen Moore, the Club for Growth, and Grover Norquist, and you know, the Americans for Tax, whatever it is, and you get these guys out here promoting these policies, but they call it something different. They try to hide it. They try to cover it up. They try to phony it up. They say, oh, no, we're actually trying to strengthen Social Security. Why don't they just come right out and say that, you know, they think that Social Security is a welfare program, that Roosevelt was all about welfare programs, that welfare programs have no right in America. Let's just get rid of them. Why don't they? I mean, occasionally it leaks out. Occasionally it leaks out. For example,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
See, I mean, occasionally it leaks out. But usually they don't want to be honest about this stuff. They, you know, just don't want to say what's really going on. Hey, it's all about letting corporations and the wealthy elite rule this country, period. And the will of the majority, be damned. If the majority say that they, you know, they want to have some social safety net, that they want to have a national Arctic wildlife preserve, that we the majority would like to have gas mileage standards for our auto fleet so that we're not so dependent on oil that we're over in Iraq. Tough. This is that worldview. And you know, as I said, I really respect these guys for being upfront and honest about it. Most of the conservatives out there are not and will not. They will talk about it among themselves, but they won't come on a program like this and talk about it. Liz in Philadelphia on the line, 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Hey, Liz, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think Dr. Brook is advocating a huge contradiction that he says government should protect us, protect our freedom, but if a corporation harms me, leaves me disabled, or kills me, my remedies are all reactive. Well, protection is prospective. You can't do it after the fact. And so what he's really creating here is a presumptive right to harm in corporations. Harm first, clean it up later. That's the stupidest, most inefficient way to do
things. Yet that's the major policy of the United States government. The Europeans are completely different on this. They have what's called the precautionary principle. Before you can put something into the food supply, for example, and this is why we're having the big debate with them about genetically modified organisms, you have to prove it's safe. Here in the United States, you don't have to prove it's safe. All you have to do is once somebody else proves that it's harmful, you have to pull it.
Yeah. Moreover, I'd like to hear him tell me what two adjoining landowners do when one of them has decided the best use of his land is a use that's inimical to the other landowner. What if there's a stream between our properties and I decide the best use is to dump sewage in it?
Yeah, or, you know, one of the folks in our chat room said, where does this guy live? I want to start a shooting range next door to him.
You
know,
there you go.
Just not to shoot him, but noise, you know. Anyway, yeah, great. Liz, thanks for the call. Well said. Well, you know, an articulate argument. I mean, this really should be the discussion that we should be having in America. Unfortunately, too often we're not. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Here they come again.
Oh, Tom DeLay. Here he comes again. I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, he says, one thing God has brought to us is Terry Schiavo to elevate the visibility of what's going on in America. He says, this is exactly the kind of issue that's going on in America that attacks against the conservative movement, against me and against many others. The point is, the other side has figured out, this is, I'm quoting from the bug man, Tom DeLay. The point is, the other side has figured out how to win and to defeat the conservative movement, and that's to go after people personally, charge them with frivolous charges, link up all these do-gooder organizations funded by George Soros, and then get the national media on their side. That whole syndicate that they have is going on right now is for one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to destroy the conservative movement! You know, one way they stopped churches from getting into politics, said Tom DeLay, was Lyndon Johnson, who passed a law that said you couldn't get into politics or you're going to lose your tax-exempt status because they were all opposed to him when he was running for president. That law, Tom DeLay says, we're trying to repeal. Oh, really? This in the private meeting of conservatives with conservatives by and for conservatives that was infiltrated by Americans United for Church and State, by Barry Lynn. And here's Tom DeLay saying that he's going to roll this back. He says, if they go and get a pastor, then other pastors shrink from what they should be doing. It forces Christians back into the church. That's what's going on in America. That's not what Christ asked us to do. My recollection, Mr. DeLay, is that Jesus said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. But in any case, and I also want to just respond to one thing Yaron Brooks said, that the Islamic terrorists are out to get us because they don't like us or because they want to establish an Islamic nation in the Middle East, but they have no right to do that because we own their oil. Osama bin Laden in 1998, it was published in the New York Times, very clear. He said, we're going to come and get you. I'm paraphrasing, of course. We're going to come and get you if you don't do two things. Number one, stop supporting the corrupt Saudi royal family because the price of oil should be $200 a barrel. And the Saudi royal family is skimming all this off, and it should be the property of the Saudi people, number one. And number two, get American soldiers, men and women, off Saudi property. We put this started in 1991 with the war against the war against Iraq, when we kicked Saddam out of Kuwait at the Prince Bandar Air Base or whatever it is. We stationed American soldiers there. And you have men drinking alcohol, women driving, women not wearing veils. And this is on holy land, according to Osama bin Laden and his Wahhabist buddies. And it made them crazy. And he said, you don't do something about that, I'm going to come and get you. And he did. The federal government has estimated there are 3.2 billion barrels of oil in the Arctic refuge, an amount representing less than 6 months of U.S. energy consumption. It'll take 8 to 10 years to get it here, and yet this is our solution. This is our solution. In America, we consume, now guess who said this? In America, we consume the most energy per capita in the world. That's got to change. The person who said that, Lewis Hughes, General Motors Vice President for International Operations. He called for a 50-cent per gallon gasoline tax. General Motors. Royal Dutch Shell recently launched a renewable energy division. British Petroleum is now in the business of making solar panels. And yet 45% of all the cars sold in the United States right now, light trucks and sport utility vehicles, if they weigh over 6,000 pounds, you can deduct from your taxes if you have a small corporation, sub-S corporation, a small business, as millions of Americans do. You can deduct up to $100,000 from your income taxes if you buy a vehicle that weighs more than 6,000 pounds. Under 6,000 pounds, you can only deduct $2,000 or $3,000 if you call it a business expense. We're paying $50 billion in taxes to protect access to Persian Gulf oil, not to mention $200-300 billion now, our war in Iraq, smog, premature deaths, air pollution, mercury in our air, and the Bush administration's response, drill for more oil. And, hey, you know, the corporations are saying go for it, so maybe that's how it should be, right? It's after all, they represent private property. You will note, for example, this from today's Montpelier Times-Argus, the newspaper here in the People's Republic of Vermont. The world's largest oil company, ExxonMobil Corporation, ended last year with $23.1 billion in cash on hand, more than double the figure for the previous year. As the Wall Street Journal reported Saturday, quote, Exxon's not alone in seeing its hoard of cash. That is the amount of money left over after paying all expenses from capital projects to taxes grow as oil prices climb higher. At Royal Dutch Shell Group, cash on hand rose from $8.5 billion in 2004 to $2 billion a year earlier. Chevron Texaco's cash jumped to $9.3 billion from $4.3 billion a year earlier. Together, the world's five biggest oil companies, which include BP, PLC, and Total SA, besides Exxon, Royal, and Chevron, Texaco, generated $67.4 billion in free cash flow in 2004. That's leftover money. That's also known as profit. And they need that oil in Anwar, because that's going to be incredibly profitable oil. It will bubble out of the ground. The more virgin oil is, the cheaper it is to pump. It's reaching the point now. Saudi oil is getting old. It's starting to cost $11, $12, $13, in some cases $15 a barrel to pump it. Much of the oil in the United States now is costing $15, $20 a barrel to pump, because you've got to suck harder on the straw when the well starts to get empty. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. If you'd like to drop into our chat room, TomHartmann.com will get you there, however you spell it. And let's go to, Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Morning, Tom. I've called a few times, and I should say this, I haven't said it. Ever since I've seen you on C-SPAN in November, right before the election, I've been addicted to your program and your writings on commondreams.org. And
well, thank you, Tom.
I really think you're just the best liberal thinker out there. You know, it's just I send your writings to everybody I know, and I try to get you on radio shows.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Anyway, you know, I had a couple questions for this guy on. You know, he said the government should protect us and defend us. I just wanted to find out, do these Ayn Rand people believe in the concept of representative democracy?
No.
They don't. No, so they admit that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, they're completely upfront about it, that democracy is mob rule, and it's not what they're in favor of.
Oh, so they really believe that, okay, I was going to say, because they conflate this capitalism and democracy, but he doesn't even believe democracy is good.
That's right. No, he thinks that I don't want to put words in his mouth, and I would encourage you to check out their website, ayanrand.org, if you want to see where this kind of thinking is coming from. And the Cato Foundation, Cato Institute, is the most pure of all of the right-wing think tanks in hewing to this line, and they produce enormous amounts of stuff, and the Heritage Foundation is right behind them. But Yaron Brook on this program has said, he's not in favor of democracy.
It's very good that you bring on these guys like him. It exposed the real thinking, like you say. Just like yesterday, that corporate shill guy for big oil to claim mercury is really benign if you just understand the literature.
There's no shortage of liberals who would love to come on the program, and we could have nice boring conversations about how terrible the Bush administration is. But frankly, I would much rather have on the other side and let people hear what they have to say. The problem is that we solicit 15 to 20 of these people a week to try and get them on the program.
And they're
sending us their news releases. They're sending us their press reports. They're saying we're available to do talk shows. They'll go on Sean Hannity. They'll go on Michael Medved. They do. I mean, they're all doing the circuit, right?
Right.
And they take one look at my website, and they say, no, I'm sorry, we won't go on your program. And at least Yaron Brook, God bless him, he'll come on the program.
I think it's good that Ann Coulter gets out there and spouts the nonsense, because she's actually helps us more. She's a caricature of the right. I think it helps us to expose it's like lampooning them. They're almost like satire when you watch them, you know. Yeah. And just like Tom DeLay, Ralph Nader says, he's a great poster boy to beat up on. I hope Tom DeLay stays in there. It helps our cause.
Yeah, well, it's one of the reasons that they got Newt out, you know, is because he was becoming a liability. Tom, I appreciate the call. I got to move along.
Sure.
Thank you so much for calling in, and thank you for your kind words. Unnecessary, but appreciated. Dave in Humboldt County, California on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Mark. Maybe the delay
Tom.
In the Coulters helped to wise up some of the thinking people, but apparently much of America remains asleep. My question, I guess the answer in a way is kind of obvious to Dr.
Brooke.
Brooks, yes, yeah. Was does he share the neocon thinking that extreme wealth for a very small group, however they obtain it, and extreme poverty for the masses is a desirable end, something worth pursuing?
Well, what he would suggest, again, I don't want to put words in his mouth, and I would encourage you to, you know, talk to him or check out his website, but my understanding of the objectivist position or the libertarian position. In fact, let's just go to the libertarian position and jump, so that I'm not speaking on behalf of Yaron Brook or the Ayn Rand Institute, is that as long as that extreme wealth is not obtained by fraud, that there's no problem. And if extreme wealth goes hand in hand with massive poverty, that's life. That's the free market. That's life. That's capitalism. That's the way it should be. And see, this is the problem that the founders were really grappling with. You had basically Alexander Hamilton and John Adams saying the same kinds of things. And on the other hand, you had folks like Thomas Jefferson, who was quoting Desuet de Tracy. Tracy had actually written the original book on economics in 1800 or 1801. Jefferson got a copy of it in French. It had been published in French. And Lafayette, the Marquis de Lafayette, who was a very dear and close friend of Jefferson's, he helped us fight the Revolutionary War. He came over here from France and was one of the major generals in the Revolutionary War, helped defeat the British, and then went back to France. And he sent a copy of this book, Tracy's book, to Jefferson and said, "You got to read this." Jefferson, while he was president of the United States, for 4 months, took 3 hours a day off from his duties as president to translate this book into English and sent it back to Lafayette saying, "Please don't let anybody know I did this," because everybody would consider it a political act. He said, "But this book has to get out there." And Tracy was the founder of what's known today as the liberal school of economics and the idea that there is a social contract. And it was the logical extension of the social contract that Rousseau had written about in the early 1600s and that John Locke was writing about in the 1600s, the idea that that society is something, that it is something. And the cons on this are saying, no, an individual is something and a corporation is something, but society is not something.
Our country has been very fortunate to have had men like him at the right time.
We need them again. And they are out there. I mean, there are some very good politicians out there, and there are some real statesmen out there, and we need to do everything we can to encourage them and to bring more into the fold, and for those among us who understand these issues to stand up and speak out and get involved in the political process. Dave, thanks so much for the call. It's great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Bob in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Well, good afternoon, Tom. Your guest that you had on, Mr. Brooks.
Yes.
Well, I kind of had to disagree with him about the government protecting business and letting business do their own things here in Grand Rapids.
I'll tell you, though, what he was saying is exactly what Alan Greenspan would say if you asked him the same things. I mean,
let me tell you, I could tell Mr. Greenspan, how would you like to come down and watch a creek flow with colors of paint that came out of the paint tanks of companies and go into the Grand River and into Lake Michigan, but we weren't polluting.
Yeah, no, when Louise and I were first married, we used to canoe on the Grand River in Michigan. it was a little messier then than it is now.
Well, the EPA and everybody has done a remarkable job on the Grand River.
Yeah.
The boys are down there right now fishing for steelhead, and they are catching some mammoth ones.
Yeah, and that's been 32 years since Louise and I were canoeing on it. And 32 years ago, you would not want to eat a fish out of the Grand River.
No, but I have to disagree with you on increasing the fuel mileage on the vehicles. It's called take your foot off the foot accelerator and increase your fuel mileage by 20 or 25% by driving like a sane human being instead of like a mad dog out there.
Well, this is what Jimmy Carter did. We lowered the speed limit all across the United States to 55, and we reduced our fuel consumption by about 2% nationally, and number two, we reduced the number of highway deaths. But, a lot of us got a little antsy with that.
Well, I can understand it, but the thing is, if you go out there on these expressways and watch people driving, the speed limit is 70 miles an hour.
Yeah.
But they're doing 80, 85, and 90.
Sure. Well, when
it
was 55,
to the fuel mileage?
When it was 55, people were driving an average of 65. I mean, people always go 10 miles
over. Well, yeah,
and
then they raised the speed limit to compensate for it, and they just added another 10 anyways.
Yeah, yeah. No, there is a certain level of personal responsibility in all this, Bob, and I agree with you. And I remember when I was a kid, my dad was teaching me how to drive. He said, always pretend that there's a raw egg between your foot and the gas pedal, and you will get better gas mileage, and your car will last longer. And I still remember that, but that's not going to solve the problem.
To a point, but if you save, for instance, we only saved 10% of our fuel, that'd be 10% less that we're importing
If we save 10% of our
money that stayed here in this country,
if we save 10% of our fuel, that would be a third. That would be probably more than three quarters of the oil that we're importing from the Middle East, and it would be about a third of our total imports of oil, because about 54% of the oil that we use in the United States we're importing right now. Bob, I got to move along. Thanks for the call and thanks for the points that you made. I do appreciate them. Josh in Arkansas on the line. Hey, Josh, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I saw a news story today about the U.S. and the U.N. The U.N. is trying to figure out how to prosecute the Sudanese war criminals, and they want to use the ICC, the International
Criminal Court. You're right.
And the U.S. doesn't want to do that. The U.S. thinks that they're going to use that to prosecute people from the U.S. abroad, and they want to use a combination of them and the African Union.
Right.
While Nigeria has some crazy third plan that's barely fleshed.
Right. We got about 20 seconds, Josh. What's your point?
My point is, I'm wondering why can't they agree with everybody else?
Well,
everybody else,
you know, what it comes down to is Henry Kissinger is an indicted war criminal in a half a dozen different countries. You should watch the DVD, The Trials of Henry Kissinger. You can rent it pretty much at any video store. And the Bush administration and the Reagan administration back before that and the previous Bush administration basically had been protecting Henry Kissinger, and they're afraid that Bush himself might get prosecuted or Rumsfeld for war crimes for what we did in Iraq. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Okay, Lakota in our chat room says, please scold Rama. Rama, consider yourself scolded.
Chill out, what's she yelling for? Lay back, it's all been done before. And if you could only let it be, you would see.
There you go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you 4.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. At the top of the next hour, in our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, we will be talking about how to prevent your brain from deteriorating, something you didn't know about. In the meantime, let's just take a few more phone calls here. Will in Los Angeles on the line. Hey, Will, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Listening to Dr. Brooks, something occurred to me.
Yes, sir.
If they are completely against collective ownership, isn't a form of collective?
I was going to say, except that a corporate form is collective ownership, yeah, and that's where it gets a little foggy. And there's also this argument, is a corporation a person? What you will find, I mean, setting aside, again, I don't want to speak for Aaron Brook, but if you look at the conservative movement as a whole in the United States, by and large, they are absolutely in bed with this notion that a corporation is a person and should have human rights or civil rights under the Constitution.
Which is a truly bizarre idea.
It's a truly bizarre idea, but it's been law in the United States since 1886, for better or worse, and it's getting amplified and strengthened continuously. And the most recent ones, Buckley versus Viejo, and the First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti, and now Nike versus Caskey. I mean, there have been all these cases. Is Dow Chemical versus EPA that have just amplified it. It's a mess. Will, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Philip in Medford, Mass. Hey, Philip, we got about a minute left. What's up?
Hey, Tom. We were just trying to make sense of that guy. His views seem so out there, like the last caller said, just so bizarre.
He's actually intellectually honest. There is a consistency to his views, and.
Right. It just occurred to me that if they're so concerned with individual rights, then if I'm only allowed to enjoy nature, if I'm a multimillionaire and I can afford to buy it, then how is that not infringing upon my rights as an individual to enjoy
you have,
nature?
Well, you have the right to get $1 million so that you can then buy some nature.
I suppose so.
That's the bottom line. I mean, this goes back to John Calvin, you know, back in the 1600s, saying that the proof of God's blessing is wealth. And that, therefore, you know, we should make rules and laws that favor the wealthy, because obviously they're the ones that are favored by God. And poverty is a moral failure.
Right, but it's getting harder and harder to make any money.
That gets back to my point about business is a game. And Will, thanks for the call. Philip, thanks for the call. I got to move along here. But business is a game, and we the people define the rules of the game. And in my opinion, we should define the rules of the game to say, great, you want to make money? Great, that's wonderful. But you have to do it in a way that doesn't harm society. In fact, ideally, you should do it in a way that helps society. What's wrong with that? Nothing. I mean, that's how we have for a long, long time here.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. With your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Here at your radio home of democracy, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. The website, TomHartman.com, and if you would like to call your member of Congress, which I regularly encourage folks to do, even though Congress is not in session now, pretty much everyone's home for the Easter holidays. Nonetheless, certainly on weekdays, and perhaps on weekends, I don't think so, but certainly on weekdays during business hours, you can call toll-free to the Capitol, 1-877. Keep in mind, our toll-free number is 866. Congress's is 1-877-SOB-U, the letter U, S-O-B. That's the, it's not a joke. It's dead serious. That's the telephone number for the House, the Senate, and the White House. Toll-free, 1-877-SOB-U-S-O-B, and it will get you to the United States Senate. That said, it is that time of the week where we go a little beyond what you may have known or thought you knew or not thought you know but didn't know that you didn't know that didn't know you needed to know, that sort of...
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be. Well, speaking of out of mind, this is a relatively short Everything You Know Is Wrong, but a startling one. This from, well, actually, it's been published in various sources. It's based on a study that was first published in the Journal of Neuroscience on March 23rd. And it's been reprinted in a whole bunch of different journal science news, whatnot. This from Health Day. Diets high in the omega-3 fatty acids found in fish such as mackerel, sardines, and salmon might prevent Alzheimer's disease. The study was conducted in mice, but senior author Greg M. Cole, this from Kathleen Doheny's report, but senior author Greg M. Cole said it probably applies to humans as well. Cole, the associate director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the University of California at Los Angeles, David Geffen School of Medicine, said, and I quote, "Our data shows it works in animals. If this works in people, it's clearly going to be one of the ways we protect ourselves from Alzheimer's disease," end quote. What they did was they had two groups of mice, and they fed one of them a diet deficient in DHA, which is one of the omega-3 fatty acids that's found in fish oils and in certain vegetable oils as well, by the way. And the other group of mice was fed a diet low in DHA. And sure enough, diets low in DHA have been linked in humans in epidemiological studies to impaired mental functioning. And in Alzheimer's disease patients, they find that DHA levels are lower than in normal people. After 3 to 5 months for the mice, which translates to several years in humans, the group of mice fed the DHA-rich diet had 70% less buildup of amyloid protein in the brain. These are the sticky plaques that form, these clots that form in the brain that are characteristic on autopsy of Alzheimer's. This is how you say, oh, this is Alzheimer's. This is all these kind of lumps of dead brain tissue surrounding these what are called amyloid proteins. And that's how you know. 70% less of this stuff in the mice that had the DHA-rich diet. Not only that, omega-3 fatty acids are known to have protective effects on human hearts. And some years ago, when I first proposed this strange idea, back in 1993, I wrote a book, or 92 I wrote the book. It was published in 93, as I recall. No, it must have been published in 92, because it was 93 that Time magazine did a cover story on it and wrote an article about my book and my theory. It's called Hail the Hyperactive Hunter, was the article that Time magazine did. And it says, Tom Hartman's come up with this weird theory, you know, whatever they call it. They didn't call it weird, but where I suggested that ADHD may actually be adaptive and useful, and that people with ADHD throughout history, like Thomas Edison and Ben Franklin, were actually the spark plugs of social change. And that we need people like this, and that we shouldn't be harming them in our schools, and we shouldn't be medicating them and drugging them and things like that. When I came out and said that, of course, it created a firestorm. Now it's increasingly becoming accepted wisdom. I've written now 7 books, I think, on the topic, and numerous articles and whatnot. But as I was, when I first came out with this, a number of people in the field of evolutionary science, evolutionary biology, and evolutionary psychiatry pointed to me, or contacted me and pointed out to me, some really speculative evolutionary neurobiology stuff that was done 15 years ago or so. I don't recall the names of the researchers, but you could probably track it down on Google with a fairly easy search. And these folks had come up with the hypothesis that they called the hairless ape hypothesis, that had to do with our water history. And they suggested, there's these questions. Why is it that humans, unique from all other mammals, are hairless? Other than, you know, the tops of our heads and our armpits and our crotch. Why is it that we don't have hair, by and large, on our bodies? And the hair that we do have is very fine, number one. Number two, why is it that we can give birth to a child, and that child can survive underwater for 15, 20 minutes without taking a breath? And you can. I mean, if you don't clamp the cord, you can do that. And in fact, it was a big fad in the 70s, you know, having babies underwater. People, you know, people we knew were doing it. Why is that? Why is it that humans, and this theory that came forward was that there had been a bottleneck at some point in time, perhaps as recently as 70,000 years ago, when there was a major volcanic event all around the Ring of Fire, the Pacific Northwest, all the way down into Asia, that produced a few years of essentially nuclear winter, where the weather patterns changed so radically that there were huge firestorms that swept across continents and killed, you know, just wiped out everything. And that perhaps as few as 50 to 100,000 humans survived this event. And the ones who survived were the ones who were living on the edge of the seacoast and were able to literally hang out in the water all the time. And those who carried a gene, a genetic mutation that adapted them to living in the water, were the ones who survived to pass along their genes, and the others didn't. So this hairless ape, the aquatic ape theory is what it's called, the aquatic ape theory. Now, I don't know if this is true or not. I'm not here as a proponent of that. But I find it interesting that now that they're finding that the fatty acid balance in fish oil is identical to the fatty acid composition of human brains, and that and other mammals as well, oddly, and that when you give people these fatty acids, you know, the brain being 80% fat, they don't develop Alzheimer's. So anyhow, that's our Everything You Know Is
you
Wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Maybe. So here now, I want to share with you this remarkable little clip. This getting back into the world of politics, as it were. This was on Vermont Public Radio, VPR. Monday night, on VPR, they have a program called Switchboard. And Jim Jeffords is the senator from Vermont, and so he was on as a guest. And he had a candid moment with the fellow who I think is Steve Zind, who was interviewing him. And I just listened carefully to this question and Jeffords' answer. This from a few days ago. This is a couple of days ago.
But does the situation now in Iraq essentially show that he made the right decision?
That was the question. Basically, you know, did George Bush make the right decision? You know, democracy on the march, all that kind of thing. Now let's hear what United States Senator Jim Jeffords, lifelong Republican until 2001, has to say about this.
I don't believe so. I was against it at the beginning, and I'm still against invading Iraq. I think it's created huge problems. I feel that we should never have gone in there. I think it was all done to get oil.
What? It was all done to get oil?
I think that that's the end result. It's going to be some oil agreement. And to the loss of life that we had and to the cost of it was, to me, just a re-election move. And
a re-election move? That George W. Bush just did this to get re-elected in 2004? This is a United States senator saying this.
They're going to try to live off it and probably start another war. Wouldn't be surprised.
Another war?
Next year. Probably in Iran.
Do you think that's likely?
Well, I probably shouldn't even talk on it. I just feel so bitter about the thinking that's gone on behind them and the reasons they go to war and went to war. But I feel very strongly that they're looking ahead and that there'll be an opportunity to go into Iran and try to get their son elected president. I don't know, but to do it each time they when I have a new president. I'm very, very, yes. Oh, well, I better be quiet.
Yeah, I better be quiet. Every time the Republicans want to have a new president, they have a new war. And now, what's the response? Okay, 3 days later, the headline in today's newspaper, the Montpelier, Barry Montpelier Times-Argus, this the state capital newspaper, the lead story in letters an inch tall across the very top of the newspaper, all the way from the left to the right. I mean, this is like, you know, World War II ends, those kinds of headlines. GOP goes hard after, quote, turncoat, end quote, Jeffords. And here's the article by Darren M. Allen, Vermont Press Bureau, Montpelier, declaring that it's payback time. The Vermont Republican Party is seeking money from out-of-state donors in its bid to oust Senator James Jeffords, the independent whose defection from the GOP in 2001 stripped control of the U.S. Senate from the party of for two years. And then they go on to talk about this fundraising letter that was sent out. The tone of the letter, which Barnett said has already resulted in healthy donations, was immediately denounced by Jeffords' campaign manager as mean-spirited and unseemly. What did the letter say? The letter said, and I quote, "Elected as a Republican, turncoat Jeffords decided to single-handedly turn over control of the U.S. Senate to Tom Daschle and the Democrats. By working together, we can give Jim Jeffords what he deserves, forced retirement, and warn those who might think of doing the same thing in the future that they should think twice before pulling a Jim Jeffords." Carolyn Dwyer, Jim Jeffords' campaign manager, said, "What surprises me most is that a Vermonter would call for a nationwide attack on our senator." She said, "This isn't Washington, this is Vermont, and this type of gutter politics doesn't belong here." Diane Snelling, a Republican state senator from Chittenden County, says this is just trash. This is not an appropriate way to campaign. The four-page letter calls Jeffords a thorn in the side of President Bush and the Republican Party. Barnett wrote, "My fellow Vermont Republicans and I are still outraged by Jim Jeffords' treachery. Treachery! How dare he tell the truth? What? A war for oil? A war to get George Bush reelected? He's going on the radio and he's saying this? We've got to stop this man. Send us your money now." And they say the letter has already resulted in, quote, healthy donations, end quote. The Republicans are really, really on a roll, aren't they? 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you in the No Boring Zone. Uncommon Sense in the Radical Middle. In the chat room, somebody, let's see, Diesel Creek. Frameless as Jeffords, a real Republican, has been pushed aside by Republicans in name only. Someone else said, "Hey, there's a Republican I could vote for." Actually, that's a Republican I did vote for. Jim Jeffords is the first Republican that I think I have voted for in my life, frankly. I mean, as I say, you know, when I was 13, I worked on Barry Goldwater's campaign, but by the time I was 16, Republican has been pushed aside by Republicans in name only. Someone else said, hey, there's a Republican I could vote for. Actually, that's a Republican I did vote for. Jim Jeffords is the first Republican that I think I have voted for in my life, frankly. I mean, as I say, you know, when I was 13, I worked on Barry Goldwater's campaign, but by the time I was 16 or 17, I was firmly in the anti-Vietnam War camp. I had changed my mind rather dramatically once I became of draft age and conscious. And moved to Vermont here 10 years ago, and Jim Jeffords seemed like a very decent guy. So I voted for him for the Senate 4 years ago when he was a Republican. And I voted for, this was in the year 2000, and I voted for a Green, Ralph Nader, and I voted for a Democrat, Pat Leahy, and I voted for an Independent, Bernie Sanders. So, you know, for those of you who are trying to figure out what category I'm in, I guess I really am one of those people who is not a category. In any case, welcome back to our program. Ellen Ratner with us from the Talk Radio News Service, 1-866, by the way, 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Ellen, we were just playing an audio clip of Senator Jim Jeffords saying that he thought that George Bush went to
20-some seats.
Yeah, yeah. And now we've had a couple of senators, I forget who it was, I've got it in my stack here someplace, writing to the Senate Ethics Committee, or the whatever the committee is that supervises this stuff. It's called the Ethics in the House. It's something else in the Senate. Saying, who produce this memo? Let us know. I mean, let's investigate this thing. Because if there's a memo floating around on the floor of the Senate, it's supposed to have the signature of a senator on it. If it's anonymous, you know, senators could be operating on phony information. This is supposed to be honest stuff out here. And
right. Well, so I think
we'll
that see. This is going to be a whole reevaluation of really of their plans, because they went into this, you know, hoping to hype up their base.
Yeah.
And they won the election, Tom, thinking that, you know, they had a real mandate. Well, they don't. But this is one other interesting little thing that just came across my desk. And, you know, hard to come up with interesting news when there's nobody in town. But Donald Rumsfeld, you know, was in Brazil yesterday. Today he's in Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
And he is suggesting that the United States increase their military aid to Guatemala and also perhaps a transformation toward as a peacekeeping force in terms of the Guatemalan military. Doesn't it sound like something you've heard several years ago?
Sounds like something I heard last time Don Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense. I mean, this is incredible. Or when Dick Cheney was, rather. This is just incredible. And keep us out of the International Criminal Court, by the way. You know.
They're moving in that, and also keep your eye on Venezuela because, as you know, we tried to unseat Chavez, and it looks like he is, you know, looking more towards Castro and some other issues. And yesterday, actually, Rumsfeld said that what does he need 100,000 AK-47s that he'd be getting from Russia?
Right. Small stuff. I mean, Chavez just cut a deal with China to sell him oil.
Right. So just keep your eye there. We're going to be hearing all about the evil empire in Venezuela very shortly.
Yeah, no doubt, because oil is at stake here. They are, what, our fourth largest supplier of oil, I believe, Venezuela is?
Right.
It's right
exactly.
Up there in the top five.
Exactly, and they've got it.
Yep, and they sure do, yeah. Ellen Ratner.
We're not working on Easter Friday or whatever tomorrow Good Friday is, but we'll talk to you next week.
Great, we'll see you on Monday. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Tom Hartman here with you, 29 minutes past the hour on Talk Radio for the rest of us.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, friends. Hang on. It's the radio home of democracy.
Hold on tight to your dream.
Dreaming of democracy.
Hold on tight to your dream.
Did you see, by the way, the stories are starting to come out now? You probably won't see them on TV, where the television industry is so addicted to drug company money with all of their advertising which used to be illegal, by the way, and we used to hear about toxic drugs. Now it's legal for the pharmaceutical companies to plaster the airwaves with ads for their products, and thus the TV industry, suddenly the news divisions of the TV industry are less interested in reporting on this. But there has been this startling pattern that virtually all, as far as I can tell, and I may be wrong on this, but I don't think so. I've been paying fairly careful attention for a lot of years. I've been, you know, I've been writing about psychiatry and psychoactive drugs and things like this for the better part of 15 years. That the vast majority of these school shooters are kids who are on selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drugs, SSRI drugs. And what these drugs do is they, by inhibiting the reuptake of serotonin in the brain, they, in other words, the recycling, the drawing up of it, the reducing of the levels of it, they increase the levels of serotonin, and they cause a sense of disassociation. So that when a person takes these SSRI drugs, they feel like they are detached from themselves. Like they're not quite inside themselves. There's this dissociated state, pharmacologically induced dissociative state is induced, a mild one. And the theory is that if somebody's seriously depressed, you want to disassociate them from that depression, which they experience as being part of themselves, for a short period of time so they can get some breathing room and they can recover, get their lives back together, and that's a useful thing. And there's a legitimate argument to be made for that if it's done over a very short period of time and there's a lot of therapeutic interaction. But instead, what's happening increasingly is physicians are simply giving people these drugs for years at a time. And it looks like this kid in Minnesota had been hospitalized over a year ago and put on these drugs and may have been, I've seen two news reports indicating that he was. But, you know, I don't have firsthand knowledge, so I can only you know, quote what's in the news, that he was on one of these SSRI drugs, as were so many, you know, Klebold and Harris, the whole bunch. I mean, you go on down the list. And of course, in the last year, we've discovered that the pharmaceutical companies have known for some time that one of the main side effects of taking these drugs is suicide. Why? Because you're disassociated from yourself. If you're disassociated from yourself, then the idea of killing yourself isn't quite as scary. Well, it also disassociates you from other people. They become a it rather than a us. And so the idea of killing them isn't as weird. And so what we have here in these school shootings in most cases is simply suicide done in what they consider to be high style. Suicide done, you know, going out with a bang. And I am personally of the opinion that we would not be seeing this epidemic of school shootings and suicides in the United States if we weren't passing out these SSRI drugs to these kids like candy. Now, I may be wrong, and time will tell. The epidemiological studies need to be done, and I sure hope somebody's looking into this. I really do. And I suspect that probably nobody is, because there's no money to be made in saying, hey, don't take something. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Dr. Jay Davis in Arcata, California on the line. Hey, Dr.
Hi, Tom.
Jay.
How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
Well, I just want to comment on what you were talking about, the hairless humans.
Yes, sir.
And you mentioned that there was a thought that 70,000 years ago something happened. There's a great book called The Descent of Woman by a woman named Elaine Morgan. And she makes exactly this hypothesis, but she says it didn't happen 70,000, but 10 million years ago.
Yeah.
And it explains why, not only, I mean, you have to explain, first of all, why we don't have body hair, but why we do have head hair.
Right.
And if people lived on the seashore, as she claims, or as our ancestors did, then, and they spend their time in and out of the water.
I think I've just lost you. But the point that I suspect you were going to make is that the head hair would have protected you from the sun and from being burned by the sun. And if that's the point you were going to make, spot on. I agree with it. It's just a whole fascinating hypothesis. You know, just Google aquatic ape, and I'm sure you'll find it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jerry in Boulder Creek, California, on the line. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I love your work. A couple things, and I just inserted another one, so give me a second. First of all, fish oil. Mackerel is not mercury safe, so people shouldn't be getting their fish oil from pills. They should be getting them from mercury safe fish, number one.
Well, or number two, there are several several companies. I know Enzymatic Therapy, for example, has a product, Eskimo brand, and I'm not pitching a company. I just know this personal firsthand knowledge. I know the people who make these things. They have a product called Eskimo brand fish oil capsules, which are not only like triple distilled or something, stripped of all heavy metals, but they're also tested for and stripped of all the heavy hydrocarbons, you know, the PCBs and all the other things that you find in fish oils.
Well,
and so you want to check the labels and make sure it's as pharmaceutical grade.
Two questions, but let me just give a brief opinion.
Sure.
First, okay?
Yeah.
Number one, kids and psychoactive drugs, whether it's Ritalin or SSRIs, most of the kids who are on them get far too little physical activity and have far too little social interaction. And as you know, you get kids outside running around and connecting with others, and that'll take care of the problem.
Sure, and they have far too much television, which I consider a neurological drug, a neurotoxin.
Right. Okay, so now you're the expert, and you've written extensively on these matters and very well, so I need some clarity here. First of all, how is it possible for us to unhook from our addiction to relatively cheap Middle East oil in the time necessary without major economic consequences in the same way that a heroin addict can't get off his addiction without, you know, major physiological rebound effect?
Yeah.
And secondly, you know, I'm a longtime labor guy. I worked at AFL-CIO headquarters and so forth. But how is it that we can compete with far cheaper labor? And as the world becomes increasingly competitive, isn't the natural outgrowth this conservative hunkering down and threatened mentality, which you've written about very eloquently, that emerged in Germany?
Yes.
Isn't that why values trumps economics?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way, but to deal with your second question first, historically, the way that nations have dealt with disparities in labor costs, and I mean, this goes back to Adam Smith literally wrote about this in 1776 in The Wealth of Nations, and it certainly goes back way before that. The way that nation, and you go back and you look at the trading bloc that was formed in the southern coast of the Netherlands, the southern regions of the Netherlands, there are these 10 states, and they none of them exist anymore. They're now like counties of Holland and northern Germany, but there were this federation of 10 states. I forget the name of it now. There's this long Dutch name. I wrote about it in What Would Jefferson Do? And you look at how they organized themselves back like in the 10th century and the 9th century, you know, a thousand years ago. And what you see is that countries have said, okay, if we're going to try to have a particular standard of living, then we need to maintain a certain level of commerce within our country. We need to maintain a certain level of the ability to produce our own goods that we will use, a self-sufficiency within our own country. And so the way that we're going to do this is by tariffs. The first tariffs that were passed in the United States after we became a nation, specifically, and it said, for the protection of domestic industry, were promoted by a guy by the name of Tench Cox. I have his biography right next to me here. It's called Tench Cox and the Early Republic. It's just a marvelous book. He's a guy nobody knows about. He started the first chamber of commerce in the United States. And he was a small businessman who initially opposed the revolution because he thought it would be bad for business. It was. After the revolution was over, he decided to stay. He wasn't a loyalist. He wasn't a Tory. And he became very active. He never was elected to office, but he was like what you might call today kind of a gadfly. Everybody knew him. Ben Franklin knew him. Jefferson knew him. And people write about him. In fact, Jefferson, you find dozens of references in Jefferson's letters to Tench Cox. And Tench Cox pushed through Congress this tariff. And we have had tariffs from then until Reagan started tearing these things down. Now, and in fact, you know, in part response to the reduction of tariffs during the 1920s, when the Great Depression happened, in response to that, you know, we saw Herbert Hoover in 1930, you know, push through Smoot-Hawley, which raised our tariffs, some would say, excessively high. But in any case, the theory of them is, if you want to make a pair of shoes, for example, and to make that pair of shoes in the United States, there's a dollar's worth of labor that goes into that pair of shoes. And if you want to make them in Malaysia, it's only 10 cents worth of labor. Then whenever shoes are imported from Malaysia, there's a 90-cent tax, a tariff, placed on them. So from the manufacturer's point of view, if they make them in the United States, there's a dollar labor cost. If they make them in Malaysia, there's a dollar labor cost. $0.10 plus the 90-cent tax is a dollar. So why not just make them in the United States? And that's why we had industry, and we were essentially self-sufficient until Reagan and this conservative economics came along. And Reagan started dismantling that. George Bush Sr. went full tilt boogie. Bill Clinton got on the bandwagon, signed NAFTA and GATT. People like, you know, Ross Perot, who were considered weird cranks, were going, hey, wait a minute, you're giving away our country, and now we produce 16% of what we consume. And so the solution to it is to go back to protective tariffs. And people say, oh, wait a minute, that's protectionism. Yes, it is. And this is the big debate that's happening in Europe right now. The French and the Germans are just, you know, they just blocked the EU from opening all the borders to services, because earlier they, you know, a few years ago they opened them to manufacturing, and now everybody's setting up manufacturing plants in Hungary and Czechoslovakia because labor is cheaper. And now they want to do the same thing with like call centers. And in the end, France and Germany said, no, you're not going to take our call centers. You already took our manufacturing jobs. Well, we they're pulling back. We need to be pulling back, and frankly, that's the healthy thing for the United States. Your first question, again, refresh my memory. What was your first question?
My first question had to do with addiction to.
Oh, that's right. Yes, and my answer to that. And I'm gonna drop you, Jerry, and just, you know, go on a rant on this thing. But I appreciate your calling. The window has closed. The window that we had to get off our addiction to oil in a way that would be relatively painless closed, in my opinion, around 1980. And Jimmy Carter, from 1976 to 1980, was saying to us, was it 76 to 80? Carter? No, it must have been 72 to 76, and whenever it was, when Jimmy Carter was president, because then you had, yeah, and then, well, no, that was, yeah, 76 to 80, and then we had Reagan, and then we had Bush, yeah. In any case, Jimmy Carter was saying to us, if we don't become energy independent of the Middle East, we are going to start fighting wars in the Middle East for oil, and that's not something we want to do with our young people. We don't want to be in that situation, and we don't want to be held black. You know, we don't want to be held hostage. We don't want to be blackmailed by them again, because everybody in America remembered what happened when Nixon was president. By the way, folks in the chat room corrected me. It was Nixon in 73 who dropped speed limits to 55 to save fuel, and the reason why was because the Arabs in the Middle East, in response to our supporting Israel in the, I believe it was the Six-Day War, said, that's it. You know, we're cutting off your oil supply for a while. And boom, we had, you know, long lines at the gas stations and all that sort of thing. And there's a huge spike in oil prices. And Carter said, we've got to get energy independent, and pushed laws through Congress to jumpstart the solar industry and biomass industry and insulating of homes and all these sorts of things to increase our efficiency and reduce our consumption. And if we had continued on the trajectory that Jimmy Carter had laid out, right now we would probably be independent of Middle Eastern oil, at least. Middle Eastern oil represents only about a third of what we import. And of the oil that we use, only we import a little more than half of it. We would be independent of Middle Eastern oil. We wouldn't be in Iraq. We wouldn't have people dying on the battlefield over there. We wouldn't have George Bush strutting around. We never would have been attacked by Osama bin Laden if we had simply followed the path that Jimmy Carter had laid out. But instead, Ronald Reagan, who came into office with all this oil money, his first official act of office was to remove the solar collectors from the roof of the White House and turn the thermostats back up so people didn't have to wear sweaters. Jimmy Carter was trying to set an example for us. Ronald Reagan said, hey, it's party time. Let's let the multinational corporations make a pile of money. Let's just boogie on. It's party time. Tony in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom.
Oh, and let me just finish up in my answer to Jerry, Tony, before you go on, if you don't mind. By saying that the window closed in 1980, that doesn't mean that it's like we're facing an absolute total disaster right now. My point is that we're going to have to make that transition, but it's going to be much more difficult. It's going to be much more painful. We are going to have, in my opinion, we're going to have some very, very serious economic consequences as a result of our dependence on foreign oil. And it's not going to be pleasant. It's not going to be fun. And you want to get out of debt as quickly as you can and as self-sufficient as you can. And I don't mean to sound like, you know, Howard Ruff or some survivalist, but I think that some tough times are coming. I'm not convinced that disastrous times, you know, the Mormons, you know, have a year worth of food in your basement thing. You know, that's not what I'm preaching. But the point is that I think that it's going to, and every day that goes by, that we refuse to address this in a meaningful way is going to make it worse. And that's why it's so important in 2006 that we have rational politicians elected to office in the House and Senate, and that we start to take back this country for we the people instead of for the oil companies. Now, Tony, your turn.
All right. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
When is the House getting the bankruptcy bill? Do you know that or not?
I don't know. I would assume, you know, within the next few weeks, but I just don't know. I don't know when it's scheduled. That would be a question. Tomorrow, call Bernie Sanders and ask him. He would probably know.
All right. And one more thing on this Terry Schiavo thing. I just like to say to the Republicans, you wonder why we don't like Bush. He will go to Washington and cut his vacation short to sign a bill for one woman, but he will go golfing when he gets a memo that's saying we're going to be attacked.
Right.
Plain and simple.
Yeah. And actually, he went out and cleared brush is what he did. And then he took the longest vacation. And he went golfing the next day. But
sorry for the mistake.
Same point. Yeah. No, Tony, I mean, this is so spot on. And here you've got the Republicans thinking that this was the thing that was going to save them. You know, Tom DeLay now equating himself with Terry Schiavo and equating himself with Jesus Christ, conflating these three things. And you know, one of the folks in our chat room, well, I need not go any farther. Enough said. Tony, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. It's a tragedy and the most bizarre, painful, awful, tragic part of it is how it has been exploited by Tom DeLay and the Republicans in the House and Senate for what they thought would be political advantage and may even ultimately turn out to be. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What a wonderful, wonderful world this would be. What a wonderful, 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 wonderful world.
Yes, indeed, if we just bring democracy back. Welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, sending a message on trade, writes David Sirota. On Alternet, on the website, David is long of the Center for American Progress, and I think he might be out on his own more these days. In any case, he points out Representative Rob, Portman, a Republican, has been nominated by George W. Bush to be our new U.S. trade representative. Portman, of course, is the former congressman from Ohio. And you would think that a congressman from Ohio would have some understanding of the fact that when you have a trade policy that says to other countries where labor costs one-tenth of what it costs here, okay, cool. If you want, you know, if American companies want to go over there and set up factories and basically ship labor back into the United States in the form of finished products, that's okay. That jobs get wiped out. You would think somebody from Ohio would figure that out, given that Ohio has lost so many jobs. But Mr. Portman actually claimed, this is a real quote, I am not making this up, a real quote, Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, quote, I don't think GM, that's General Motors, went to Mexico because of NAFTA. It's a North American Free Trade Agreement. I don't think GM went to Mexico because of NAFTA, end quote. Although, all you have to do is look at the timeline. Bill Clinton signs NAFTA, and what does GM do? 38,000 workers, 38,000 jobs, shut down in the United States, open up in Mexico. Why not? I mean, we've changed the rules of the game. We've said to General Motors, hey, you can do this if you want. No problem. General Motors, as you know, being a corporation, their first loyalty is to profit. And as I said before, there's nothing wrong with that. We set the rules of the game. We determine how they can make that profit. If we're going to say, hey, you can make that profit by exporting American jobs, they will. And they did. And they continue to. Portman says, open markets create jobs, a higher standard of living, and greater economic growth. Well, true, if you're the Chinese. But, you know, Portman's trade policies, I mean, these very trade policies have wiped out a million American jobs just since George Bush became president. Well, actually, maybe he was just talking about CEOs. Open trade policies do establish a higher standard of living for CEOs. I'll bet that was it. So he wasn't a lying weasel. He was just speaking of CEOs, and he forgot to mention that. That must be that. This is our new trade representative. Aren't we fortunate to have George in the White House? Such a wise guy.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, victory has been declared in Georgetown. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you on the radio home of democracy, the Tom Hartman radio program. Started out 22 students at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., stopped eating. They have lost, according to their website, a total of 270 pounds. It's grown beyond 22 students. The website is georgetownlivingwage.org. And we just got a note from David Swanson, who had been on our program. It was either earlier this week or late last week. I think it was Monday of this week, telling us the story of this. And that he says, hey, they won. Now, this was at a Catholic university, and the students were basically saying, hey, the teachings of Catholicism are that you pay a laborer his worth. I mean, a workman is worthy of his wage, I believe, is the way that Jesus is quoted in the New Testaments. Something to that effect, anyway. And I used to actually have a collection of quotes on this stuff, but I don't have it easily right here. But in any case, it's been a big issue. It's been going on for a couple of weeks. These kids have lost a bunch of weight. This is college students standing up and on behalf of the janitors in their school saying, these people deserve to be paid a living wage. And they finally won. I think it's marvelous. So, georgetownlivingwage.org. Check it out. And David also says, here's a doozy from ABC News. They've signed up Walmart as a sponsor for their Only in America series. No irony intended. The United Food and Commercial Workers, the UFCW, asking ABC News President David Westin to drop Walmart immediately as a sponsor of Good Morning America's Only in America series. And you can email ABC News at support@abcnews.go.com, apparently. And unionvoice.org has all the information about that. So things move on. Things move on. And here we have now Senator Lautenberg asking for an investigation into the GOP talking points memo. Senator Frank Lautenberg has sent a formal letter to Senators Trent Lott of Mississippi, Republican of Mississippi, and Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut, Democrat of Connecticut. And, of course, the Republicans controlling the Senate. Good luck, Senator Lautenberg, on seeing anything come out of this. He says, last week, the attached document, and what's attached is this memo, this talking points memo, that was circulated among the Republicans on the floor of the Senate as they were debating the Terry Schiavo piece of legislation. This memo, which said this is a great political opportunity for us, and this will energize our base. And so he says, late last week, the attached document was distributed to Republican senators. The document consisted of talking points relevant to the brief relief legislation, the private relief legislation for Terry Schiavo. The document is not on any letterhead, nor is its source identified. Media reports suggest the document was distributed on the floor of the Senate by the Republican leadership. That would be Senator Frist and Senator Santorum. However, notes Senator Lautenberg, Senators Frist and Santorum have denied distributing it, which raises the possibility it was distributed by staff. Now, that's something that should not happen. I mean, it's just that simple. It should not happen. As Senator Lautenberg points out, he says, the distribution of anonymous material on the Senate floor is troubling. There is a policy in place, at least among the Democratic conference, requiring that any materials to be distributed to senators on the floor must bear the signature of one or more senators. This is an important safeguard to identify the source of information and protect the integrity of such materials. Those who would attempt to influence debate in the United States Senate should not hide behind anonymous pieces of paper. And so Senator Lautenberg continues in his letter to Senator Trent Lott. Pardon my laughing. I am sorry. It's just to think that the Republicans are going to suddenly get concerned about ethics. It's like thinking that Bill Clinton joke comes to mind, but I'm not going to say it. In any case, in light of this troubling incident, he says, I am writing to request that the Rules Committee conduct an investigation of the attached document, its source, and how it came to be distributed. And I further request that the Rules Committee consider whether it would be useful to amend the standing rules of the Senate regarding the Senate chamber in order to address the situation. I look forward to hearing from you on how you are going to proceed in this manner. Sincerely, Frank R. Lautenberg. Yes, Senator Lautenberg, good luck. Good luck. If you think you're going to hear from these people. I mean, here we have Tom DeLay. New charges now. And you wonder why is he grandstanding on the floor of the House about Terry Schiavo let's call everybody back. New charges against DeLay stem from two trips he took, one to England, largely paid for by a lobbyist for Indian gaming interests, and one to South Korea, paid for by an agent of the South Korean government. 2 months, this from recordonline.com, Times Herald Record. This a newspaper based out of Scotland, of all places. 2 places after the England trip, DeLay voted against internet gambling regulations, legislation opposed by the tribe. In other words, he did what he was paid to do, what he was bribed to do when he went to England. The concern with the Korean trip stems from the fact that accepting funds from registered foreign agents is against House rules. You will recall the last time Tom DeLay broke the rules and committed what may have actually even been a crime, but certainly was a violation of House rules. We'll never know if it's legally a crime because the Republicans said, we are not going to investigate this. But the Republicans on the House Rules Committee said, well, 3 times now, they have admonished him. They have slapped his hand. And so what did he do? He changed who's on the Rules Committee. He got rid of 2 of the Republicans who have been on there forever, got him off, and replaced him with 2 good old boys from Texas who he gives money to. Yes, Tom DeLay has his own political action fund. In fact, it's that political action fund that he might go to jail for in Texas because it's been taking money from corporations, and that's against the law in Texas. One of his good buddies has already been indicted and is facing hard jail time. This is starting to sound like Silvio Berlusconi. DeLay also remains a figure in an investigation into campaign finance and redistricting irregularities in Texas, where some of his allies have already been indicted. Not to mention, nobody ever even brings this up anymore, the fact that he got the Department of Homeland Security and Tom Ridge to chase Democrats as if they were terrorists using federal funds in violation of federal law. Oh, but let's quickly change the topic, says he. And this, I thought this was there was an interesting and insightful analysis by Carl Hulse and David Kirkpatrick in the New York Times about this whole thing around Terry Schiavo. You have Richard Balch, of the National Right to Life Committee, talking about Judge Whittemore. Judge Whittemore is, of course, the federal judge when Congress, when DeLay and Frist got the House and the Senate back together in Hastert, House and Rick Santorum got the Senate and the House back in session from vacation just to pass one piece of legislation saying that the analysis of Terry Schiavo's situation should be seen, should go into the federal courts rather than just the state courts. You have this situation where the national right to life, and this judge said, so it goes to the federal court, and the judge, Whittemore, a Clinton appointee, Fox News will never let you forget. He says, no, thanks. You guys have not demonstrated that there's any chance that you're going to win this case, and so I'm not going to issue a restraining order that would put the feeding tube back in. And so then they go to the whole bunch of judges, the whole 11-judge panel, as I recall, including appointees by George Walker Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton. And they say, no, sorry. But anyhow, Richard Balch of the National Right to Life Committee, he says, Judge Whittemore has engaged in a gross abuse of judicial power. And you've got Richard Viguerie, the strategist behind conservative direct mailings. He says, this could be the opening shot in the Supreme Court nomination battle that we expect sooner rather than later. And this is, I believe, what this has been all about. The whole Terry Schiavo thing, yes, there is significant benefit to the Republicans in changing the subject away from the fake news fiasco. I would say the fake news crimes, federal crimes. It is against the law to use taxpayer money to submit propaganda to the people of the United States. It is a crime. It is a federal crime. And not only has the Bush administration been doing it, but Bush, in a press conference a couple days ago, said they're going to continue doing it. And it's against the law, according to, and Congress looked into this, and the Congressional Accountability Office, and they said, this is against the law. Bush says, we're going to keep on doing it. This isn't advocacy. And then they distribute a video of a bunch of Iraqis in Detroit going, thank you, President Bush. God bless you, President Bush. This isn't advocacy. Right. So there was a fallout there, a beneficial fallout for them, in that the subject got changed away from Jeff Gannon and the whole Republican gay hooker business and the fake news stories and all the manipulation of the media by the Republicans. And truth be told, by more than a few Democrats over time. This is not something that the Clinton administration didn't do, although the Bush administration has turned it into an art form. So there was a benefit in that, and there was a benefit in changing the conversation away from Tom DeLay's ethics troubles. But in my opinion, these guys are spot on, Carl Hulse and David Kirkpatrick, that what this is really about, and of course this is what Richard Viguerie said, is the conservatives are coming around and saying this is what this is really about. But what they're really trying to do is they're trying to say to the American people, you see, the judiciary, the branch of the government, the judicial branch of the government is out of control. These judges have gone crazy. They're letting people die. We need to get more conservative judges on the Supreme. This is the rationale that they're going to use to put forth the most extremist right-wing cranks for the Supreme Court. And they think, and perhaps correctly, that this whole mess is going to give them some support in that. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And stand up, my friends.
Stand up for your right.
Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Welcome back. This afternoon writes John Stauber. John Stauber, who's been a guest on this program many times. John Stauber, This afternoon, I listened in on a conference call among some of the top PR executives in the business of producing video news releases, more honestly called fake news. I can report they are proud and confident that the recent flap on the front page of Sunday's New York Times about the Bush administration's use of fake news will amount to nothing at all. Now, this is fascinating. John Stout, there was a conference call held of a whole bunch of executives in the PR industry, and the interesting part of this is that most of the fake news that is created in the United States, I mean the vast majority of it, 90-95% of it, is not fake news coming out of the Bush administration. I mean, they have taken hundreds of millions of your and my tax dollars to generate fake news. But that doesn't constitute the majority of the fake news. Most of the fake news is actually coming from corporations. And in fact, it may even violate federal payola laws because many of these companies give their fake news clips. You know, Monsanto announces a new genetically modified vitamin A in the rice, blah, blah, blah. You know, a lot of the stuff that shows up, particularly on local newscasts, comes down through the network feeds. The local stations are connected to the network satellite all the time. And when when they're not running programming, they're feeding news clips that the local stations can slice and dice. And the corporations that produce these fake news clips, these video news releases, these VNRs, they call them, this fake news, corporations that do this, they give money to the networks for what's referred to as distribution costs. We're gonna cover your distribution costs, not to worry. As somebody who's been around the radio industry for a long time, I started out as a DJ back in the late 60s, and I remember it had been either the late 50s or early 60s. This was even before my time. I mean, I started in 1968 or 67, one of those 2 years. And it was years before that, but there was this huge payola scandal where DJs were being paid to play songs, and Congress actually passed laws against it. And the FCC promulgated or propagated or whatever they do, put forth regulations against it, and it's a crime. And, you know, you sign an employment contract with a radio station, for example, and there will always be a clause in there that says, you can't accept payola. It's like you can't commit a crime. This is payola. So anyhow, a bunch of these PR folks, they got together on a conference call to talk about, you know, the people in the fake news business, talk about what are we going to do about this? You know, we've been outed by the New York Times. If we've been outed by Ralph Nader, you know, we can ignore that. It'll go away. It won't get much coverage. But the New York Times. And so they had this conference call, and John Stauber, who publishes PR Watch, prwatch.org, their website, John Stauber was in on the call, and they didn't know it. And he's got all these great quotes from these people, these various PR firms. Jack O'Dwyer who arranged the thing, Doug Simon of DS Simon Productions, Stan Zeitlin of West Glen Communications. It goes on and on. And the VNRs, he says, are fake news stories paid for by clients ranging from the Pentagon to Monsanto that are aired by TV news producers as if they were independent reporting and the work of real journalists. And they're all basically saying, hey, the Terry Schiavo thing bumped it off the front pages. We don't have to worry. We can go back to producing fake news. And the industry is safe. And as long as Republicans control the House and Senate, nothing to worry about, guys, because they're all in favor of fake news, too. So, and there's, as I said, probably a few Democrats are all in favor of it as well. So on it goes. On it goes. When are we going to stand up, we the people, and say, you know, we'd like something done about this? You might try right now. The phone number for Congress, 1-877-SOB-USOB. Yes, that's the real phone number for Congress. Try it out. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America. I'm Tom Hartman with you. A simple red rose in hand. Karen Meredith leans over her son's simple white stone marker at Arlington National Cemetery. Tears fall before words, writes Rebecca Carr in the Cox News Service report today. It's Karen Meredith's first visit since she buried First Lieutenant Kenneth Michael Ballard, a fourth-generation soldier, last fall. This, her son. Still fresh, like the soil churned behind her son's grave for another row of dead, is her anger. Anger at the way the Pentagon refused her sole wish when her son was killed by a sniper last May to photograph his casket returning from Iraq. Meredith wanted to capture the way fellow soldiers respectfully draped the American flag across the casket, tucking the sides just so, and the way an honor guard watched over him as he was unloaded from a cargo plane. But the Pentagon firmly said no. Said Meredith, it's dishonorable and disrespectful to the families. They say it's for privacy, but it's really because they don't want the country to see how many people are coming back in caskets. What isn't so well known, notes Rebecca Carr, Cox News Service, what isn't so well known is that the Pentagon refuses to allow the families of dead soldiers access to the caskets returning to Dover and other military bases. We do know that they refuse to allow the press. We didn't know that families couldn't see. Says Meredith, it's bad enough when they won't let the country see the pictures of the caskets, but a grieving mother, it's unforgivable after what I lost. This was a policy that was created in 1991, by the way, when Dick Cheney was defense secretary during the first Gulf War. Bill Clinton ignored the policy. George W. Bush put it back into place. Meredith says she was prepared to lose her son in battle. What she wasn't prepared for, she says, was the way the military treated her when he died from a sniper's bullet in the head. She doesn't understand how a single photograph of his casket for her own personal album would violate her own privacy. She says, it is ironic that this policy denies us the very freedoms of the press and speech my son and so many like him gave their lives to protect, Meredith says. Well, if Jim Jeffords is right, and I tend to believe him, that's not what, sadly, I would hate to break this to her, but that's not what her son died for. He died to protect our oil supply and to get George W. Bush reelected, because during time of war, presidents tend to get reelected. This, of course, you read Bob Woodward's book, Karl Rove goes down to Crawford, Texas, and with his PowerPoint presentation in 2002, before the plans for the Gulf War were laid out, and said, I've got your reelection, 2004 reelection campaign right here. We're going to make you a strong leader, a war president. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. I almost wanted to rave and rant, but I don't think I'll do that. I think I'll focus on what happened the other night at our precinct meetings.
Okay, great.
Let me just
interrupt, Roy. Is this a Democratic precinct meeting?
Yeah, okay. In our county. Precinct meetings,
uh-huh.
And there was four precincts that got together at the schoolhouse, and the old precinct leader, who I had never heard from, showed up and was surprised that there was so many people there. We had about 40, 50 people there, and of the 14 electorates that we have going to the county convention, we won 11 of the seats. When I say we, folks that had never been to a precinct meeting before.
That's amazing. 11 out of 14 of the seats were won by people, and it was their first meeting. So you guys, basically, what you're saying, Roy, is if our listeners decide to simply show up,
that's all you got to do is show up.
Just be there. And you know, and I'll bet that it's not that different for the Republican Party, for those people who are so inclined, because I think that people of goodwill who have any interest in the Republican Party should take that party back from the corrupt corporatists who've taken it over as well. I mean, we need to take back both parties, frankly.
Although
I would have a hard time showing up at a Republican party. I just have to say, I mean, I couldn't get my lunch down. But some people, you know, it's their thing. So.
Yeah.
God bless
them. The four precincts that were at our schoolhouse. Well, number one, the old precinct leader that was supposed to be running the meeting hadn't even contacted the school to get the keys to get into the gym. She showed up with nothing. Had one of my buddies not put together the packets, we wouldn't have even had the packets to operate under. He ran the meeting. She was so surprised that everybody had showed up.
And now, how come everybody showed up, Roy?
Well, because we got out and we kind of twisted arms and we talked and we pleaded, and there was a lot of us that, like myself, that said, we owe it to our grandkids, take this country back.
Yeah.
And we're not going to lay down and let it go.
So you just decided to get active. You got your friends organized. You got some folks
and
to
it
show
was
up.
It was easy, and it was fun. No, it was not easy. But it was fun, hard work.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's just kind of like when you go work out, and doggone, it wasn't easy, but boy, it sure felt good.
Yeah, yeah.
And we passed a bring home the troops resolution.
Wow.
We passed a instant runoff voter registration.
Mm-hmm.
We voted renewal energy resolution. And, you know, so now that they will be presented next week at the ward and the county meeting.
This is great.
And we will have, I think if the math's right, it's 88% of the electorates that come out of our four precincts will be supporting changing the Democratic Party in New Mexico to get back to the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party.
And just because you showed up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there was lots of us, and it was, like I said, it was hard, but it was fun.
I got to say, Roy, you win our Good On You award.
Hey, I'll take that. I'll just stand up and pat myself on the back.
There you go.
Actually,
well done.
I'd like to pass it out to everybody else who was there. And we've just been, you know, we've been doing flyers. We've been doing just all kinds of things. I've dubbed off your first set of the NLP lessons. I've been passing those out like popcorn.
That's great. That is
and,
great.
And so it's just been... It's interesting. It's enthusiastic participation.
Yeah, I think
and we can do it. I'm just not going to quit. I owe it to my grandson to educate and agitate.
There you go. And to get him involved in it as well.
Well, he hadn't even old enough. Well, I guess he's 3 years old. He could. Come
oh, he's
right
3 years old. Okay, me, yeah. Well, you know, get his parents involved. Roy, thanks a lot for the call. And
hey, have a great one. Thanks.
You too. Well done. I am so pleased to hear this. 1-866-889-8894. Hey, Roy can do that there in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. You can do it wherever you are. For example, you, Harriet, in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Harriet, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I was off doing the other job here, kind of lost track of the chat room for a few. Anyway, little thing that I saw this morning on the big New York auto show, this is back on the old oil business again.
Ah, yes, from our first hour, or our second hour, whichever
yeah.
hour it was.
The big emphasis for the whole New York auto show was gas-guzzling, as they called them, muscle cars. And their argument for putting all these out was that, well, it's been in the development stage for the last 3 years. Well, they knew three years ago there was an oil problem.
Well, this is the same thing that the auto industry in the United States went through in the late 70s and early 80s, was, you know, Detroit kept producing gas guzzlers, and the Japanese came in and ate their lunch.
Right, right.
And right now, I mean, try and go down and buy a Toyota. What do you call it? I own one and I drive one. And I can't, what is
the hybrid?
The hybrid car, a Prius. Try and buy a Prius, or try and buy a Honda Insight. You know, it's a 6 month to a year waiting list right now.
I know. Two of my neighbors have the hybrids. They have the Hondas, and there was a long, long waiting list to get them.
Yeah.
They say they're working on it, but gee, muscle cars are still really in. And don't forget, Bush said it's a right of every American citizen to own a gas guzzler.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't actually say that. His father said the American lifestyle is not negotiable.
Right.
In the context of all of this, and so I suppose it's just the same thing. Remarkable, Harriet. Well, what are you doing about this out in Seattle?
What am I doing about it?
Yeah.
I'm not driving much, I'll tell you that. I combine all my trips and...
Speaking up and telling your friends, getting people involved?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, yeah. I'm still working on that. I send stuff out all the time. It just...
Well, and actually, I you run the Democratic Forum on CompuServe, right? You're a SysOp in the Democratic Forum on CompuServe, so you're actually very active as an advocate for change. So, you know, I salute you for that, too.
Well, we are, but it's, you know, it's the same sort of thing. You put up with all the trolls and all that sort of thing, and trying to combat the lunacy, and it just, it's like beating your head against the wall.
Yeah.
So they're still hassling out the Gregoire Rossi situation out here for governor.
Oh, you're kidding.
Nope.
So the Rossi is the Republican, and who Gregoire is...
Gregoire is the governor,
is
yeah,
the governor,
so
yeah.
far. And, you know, one of the feelings is that there's going to be a re-election. So,
really?
Yeah, they're dragging in all the felons now and having them say, well, gee, I didn't know that I couldn't vote, and nobody told them. And it just, some voted for Rossi. So, I mean, the whole thing is just a scramble.
Yeah. Felons for Rossi, felons for Gregoire. This is the new split.
It's going to be a new campaign pitch, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Harriet, thanks for the call, and thanks
Most
for keeping
welcome,
us up
Tom.
To date on what's going up out there. It's always great to hear from you. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, you have a good one. It's 16 minutes before the hour. Here's an unusual left-right coalition that has evolved. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle, an article by Edward Epstein. He points out that groups on the right, like the American Conservative Union, David Keefe, and former Congressman Bob Barr, I got to tell you, I remember Bob Barr. When Louise and I lived in Atlanta, a friend of mine was a friend of Bob Barr's, and we got together, my friend and I, we went down, his name was DeWitt, we went down to Manny Maloof's Tavern in downtown Atlanta one night to have a beer, and Bob Barr used to drop by there from time to time or whatever. He was giving a talk there, I guess it was. And so Bob Barr was, we sat at the counter and had a beer with Bob Barr. And this was before the Clinton impeachment hearings, but not that much before them. And I had always thought of Bob Barr as a very toxic right winger. I mean, just a hardcore right winger. And I was completely horrified, disgusted by his behavior during the Clinton impeachment hearings. He was one of the loudest, what do you want to say? I'm trying not to be too slasher here on him, but he was one of the most outspoken advocates of morality in high office, let's say, in a way that seemed to me quite hypocritical. You know, like sexual morality was a big deal, but people taking payoffs from big corporations, that's not anything we should be talking about. That sort of thing, which is the Republican Party. Not that the Democratic Party doesn't do the same thing. I mean, if they wanted to go after Bill Clinton for something, I would go after him for NAFTA and GATT. You know, why did that happen? Not Monica Lewinsky. So anyhow, Bob Barr, this ultra-conservative, and David Keefe, the American Conservative Union, have joined up with the ACLU and and they've created this new group. Bob Barr is actually the leader of it. It's called Patriots to Restore Checks and Balances to Fight the Patriot Act. To fight the Patriot Act. Here, Bob Barr, he said, it is not and never should be necessary to surrender our rights under the Bill of Rights to fight the war on terrorism. It's remarkable. The group, Edward Epstein notes in the San Francisco Chronicle, the group wants the section of the Patriot Act giving access to library, medical, and firearm ownership records modified to require that law enforcement officials present evidence to a federal judge supporting a link with suspected terrorism before warrants are served. The group wants similar limits on the provision allowing secret searches of homes, businesses, and personal property. And group members want the language of the section that allows surveillance of protests rewritten to require a definite connection with suspected terrorism. You get this. You know right now that using the Patriot Act, police agencies around the United States, the FBI, the Secret Service, are keeping track of anti-war protesters, are keeping track of Democratic Party anti-Bush protesters from the 2004 election. That if you were for John Kerry under the Patriot Act, you can be investigated. I kid you not, and it is happening. Tom DeLay used the Patriot Act to go after Democrats in Texas to get the FBI to follow their plane. And, of course, that's the very tip of the iceberg. And so they're trying to say, okay, if you're going to have these powers that seemingly violate the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, and here you've got, again, you've got the right-wingers, from Limbaugh to Tom DeLay, and including, by the way, our esteemed members of the Supreme Court, saying, well, there is no right to privacy specifically enumerated in the Justice Scalia, and I quote, there is no specific right to privacy enumerated in the Constitution, end quote. The Fourth Amendment, what does it say? The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. Shall not be violated. Now, why didn't they say privacy? Well, the reason they didn't say privacy is because in 1776, the word privacy meant I need to use the bathroom. And it meant that right up through the early 1800s when Thomas Crapper invented the flush toilet. And then they started changing the language. The language began to change. But back then, bathrooms were referred to as privies. And if you said I need privacy or I need to use the privy, it meant that you won't find the word privacy anywhere in the writings of any of the founders because that's what it referred to. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
With an earthquake, birds and snakes and aeroplane, Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane, listen to your...
And the FBI, the Pentagon, looking into themselves. Welcome back, my friends, to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, Viagra for your brain, the Tom Hartman radio program. U.S. law enforcement agents working at the military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This is an article by R. Jeffrey Smith in the Washington Post. Now just get this. U.S. law enforcement agents working at the military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, concluded that controversial interrogation practices used there by the Defense Department produced intelligence information that was suspect at best, an FBI agent told a superior in a memo in May last year. So here you've got... Or here you have. Yeah, it's funny. Whenever I say "got," I remember being, 8, 9 years old and having my mother say, "got" means "god" in German. You say "have." Got, or "got" means acquired. You could say, I got $30 or I have $30. They mean two different things, actually. Why am I doing an English lesson? Okay, we'll get back to this. Okay, the information, you have the FBI... This is a colloquialism. I did it again. You've got the FBI. You have the FBI. This is what happens when you grow up with a mother who has a bachelor's degree in English. You have the FBI looking into the intelligence that came out of the interrogations at Guantanamo Bay and saying, this stuff is useless. This is useless. This is worse than useless. These people will say anything to stop the pain. It's the problem when you use torture. When you shackle people to a concrete floor for 24 hours and they make them stark naked in the heat or in the cold and they're rolling around in their own excrement. And then you say, hey, we'll stop this if you'll tell us what we want to hear. And they will tell you what you want to hear. It may not be the truth, but they will tell you. And so there was all kinds of wild stuff coming out of Guantanamo. And, of course, Tom Ridge was relaying it all to us. Oh, the threat level is going up. Whenever some new scandal would break, some new corporate scandal, some new, Bushism or George W. would change his policy on this. Oh, that another, one of these guys down in Guantanamo, they said that they're going to blow up and they're going to do it, and they're going after the Super Bowl. And we just have some new information here. And the FBI now saying, nope, sorry. So then the Justice Department, which runs the FBI, looks at itself and says, when it has to report to Congress, This is a revelation from Senator Carl Levin in Michigan. The Justice Department, again, I'll just go back to this article by the Jeffrey Smith in the Washington Post, because it's very, very straightforward. But the Justice Department, which reviewed the memo for national security secrets before releasing it to a civil liberties group in December, redacted the FBI agent's conclusion. Redacted is a fancy word for they took a black felt pen and ran through it. The department acting after the Defense Department expressed its own views on which portions of the letter should be redacted also blacked out a separate assertion in the memo that military interrogation practices could undermine future military trials for terrorism suspects held at Guantanamo Bay. Why? Because it's a war crime, what they're doing. It also withheld a statement by the memo's author that the Justice Department's criminal division officials were so concerned that they took their complaints all the way to the Pentagon's chief attorney, who George Bush just appointed to be a federal judge, by the way. This William J. Haynes II. Amazing what the Justice Department doesn't want you to know about what the Justice Department knows about what they don't want you to know. We'll see you tomorrow, my friends. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. We'll be right back.